Welcome to the Space Show, David.
Thank you.
When I was a child, there used to be a lot of science fiction stories around, and one of the envisioned dangers of going into space was being hit by meteors and having your craft smashed. When we launched satellites, what did the danger actually prove to be?
Oh, the dangers are nothing like you saw in the old days science fiction movies where you have fields of great chunks of rock flying through space. It's nothing like that at all. It's much more benign than that. As you know, we have satellites up there that remain comfortable and safe for many, many years until the end of their life. And so they are all hit by tiny little meteorites, but none of these big fist-sized chunks of rock.
As far as we know, have any satellites actually been destroyed by meteorites?
Destroyed, no. Disabled, yes. There have been a number of suspected cases, and in two cases in the 90s, there have been two satellites, one European and the other Japanese, that are known to have been disabled by meteor impacts.
Do you know the names of these offhand?
Yes, the Olympus spacecraft, operated by the European Space Agency, took a number of hits while it was doing a thruster maneuver, and it ended up spinning, and they were unable to recover the spacecraft. They couldn't stabilize it, and so even though it wasn't damaged in the usual sense of the word, a small electronic component or something went haywire, and they lost the mission. The other was a Japanese spacecraft where it was making measurements of the sun, and a very tiny little meteorite penetrated the sun shield and let too much light in. So in both cases, the obvious damage was microscopic, so there was no obvious damage, but in fact the spacecraft was unable to do its mission.
We might just backtrack on that and say, okay, well, what are micrometeorites and where do they come from?
Micrometeorites is a relative term. We're talking about very tiny meteors, as small as a grain of sand. Actually, a grain of sand is a very big meteorite because of their speeds. There are two places that they come from. There's the sporadic meteors, and they come from bodies that were part of the origin of the solar system. They move in prograde orbits, where they sort of orbit the sun the same direction as all the planets do. And they're around all the time. The other population, the ones that we're concerned with, especially this year, are the meteoroids that come from comets. These are called the shower meteors because we know them, because every year we have a meteor shower. And those are a much more fast-moving set of meteors because they can come into the inner solar system from any direction, so we can hit them head-on, for example. So in the case of the Leonid meteors coming up this year, the velocities will be about 71 kilometers a second, which is very fast indeed.
The typical shooting star that people would see on a clear night, how large would that be?
A good bright meteor on a clear night might be a milligram of material, which means that it's something like this, the size of a pinhead. Okay, that's a very large particle, but most of the ones that we see coming in are much slower moving. So even a good bright optical show in the night sky, you know, a falling star, is still a tiny, tiny meteor and will burn up before it hits the ground.
We've mentioned that a lot of the dust comes from comets. And the Giotto spacecraft in 1986 passed through the dust cloud around a comet. What happened to Giotto?
It detected a number of hits, many, many hits, and so it was able to help us characterize the number of particles around a comet, so that was very useful. You'd think if it's going to go right through the dust cloud from a comet, it would be in great danger, but in that case, it was moving very slowly relative to the particles in the comet. And so they were not particularly high velocity and therefore as threatening as the ones we're going to face this year.
Of course, Giotto had a special comet or dust bumper shield, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
Do most of the other satellites have bumper shields?
No, most of them do not.
What about the manned craft like the Mir and so on that have been up there for, well, in the case of Mir, over 12 years? No shielding there?
Oh, no, a good deal of shielding. They have the structure of the skin of the spacecraft is usually a multi-layer kind of a thing, and that's very effective against these things. But nothing can withstand a big hit, but the small typical micro or milligram particles that are around a lot, they can withstand that without any trouble.
You mentioned that you're using meteor showers to assess the risk. Are insurers interested in this information?
Yes, they are, of course. They take a somewhat more legal or practical view of this. In other words, they're insuring a spacecraft and they want to know whether or not the spacecraft owners and operators who have insured their spacecraft have taken reasonable and prudent measures to deal with the meteor showers. There are a number of things that you can do to protect your spacecraft, although not many.
What are some of these things?
You could, for example, reorient the spacecraft so that the least vulnerable parts of the spacecraft were going to get hit. You could power down non-critical subsystems. You could, and one thing they will all do, I think, is avoid commanding the spacecraft or reprogramming the spacecraft or any sort of changes like that during the shower itself or during the storm anyway. In some cases, they could, if not power down subsystems, just make sure they're in a wait or safe state. In some cases, they can't do that because the mission that they're being asked to fulfill requires them to be up and operating all the time, and those people just have to grit their teeth and bear it.
Things like communication satellites.
Yeah, quite right.
And you mentioned not doing anything, and that, of course, happened to Olympus, wasn't it? They were actually doing something. It must have been hard to tell when that happened, whether the event was caused by a meteorite hit or whether it was just simply a failure of one of the systems they were operating.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good point. None of the spacecraft that we have up there are designed to detect meteor hits or impacts, or very few of them anyway. And therefore, the entire spacecraft becomes kind of a very poor meteor detector. And when you get a glitch on your spacecraft, you don't always know where it comes from. The owners and operators do in fact get glitches quite frequently, but if it does not affect their operation or if it's just a bit of static on the line, you know, for a fraction of a second, well, you know, they're not going to worry about it. Could be a meteor hit, could be something else. Okay, so the small particles they're used to dealing with, even though they don't know they're used to dealing with them. The larger ones, which are much, much rarer, again, you may not know that it's a meteor, but they will have a much more significant impact in terms of the signature on the spacecraft. You know, your electronics go haywire, you have to reboot your computers, part of a solar panel goes bad, you know, that sort of thing.
Some of the early satellites, of course, were drum-shaped, and therefore you couldn't do much about orienting it or anything. But the modern communication satellites basically have a box-shaped body and then huge solar panels that go out like giant wings on either side. Is it possible to point the wings so that they minimize the area in the direction of that's another point. Do we know the direction from which these meteorites are likely to come?
Yes, we know the direction that they're coming very, very accurately, and we know their speeds very accurately, in fact, but that's about the only thing that we know very accurately. And yes, you can reorient your spacecraft to minimize the cross-sectional area relative to the incoming particles. Most satellites, when they're in their sunbathing mode, in other words, when they have their solar panels flat onto the sun, are pretty safe. Okay, in the sense that the particles are coming in almost tangential to the Earth's orbit, and therefore, since the array panels are perpendicular to the orbit, they're in the plane of the orbit, then they're already minimized to some extent.
Do you do any work with space debris as well? The chances of a craft being hit by debris, that's man-made debris rather than natural?
Yes, quite a bit. In fact, at the Aerospace Corporation, we have a place called CORDS, the Center for Orbital and Reentry Debris Studies, and the prime mission of that organization is to monitor and understand the phenomenology of man-made space debris, do collision avoidance in space, in other words, to keep track of these things and follow them around. The particles in the case of space debris, they're much slower moving, but they're much bigger. And so that is a great concern to everybody, not only the owners and operators, the insurance people, the legal people, everyone. And so we at Aerospace are in that game big time.
How small an object can be tracked in, say, low Earth orbit?
We can presently track something of the neighborhood of 10 centimeters. That, of course, depends on its optical reflectivity, its radar reflectivity, and that sort of thing. But sort of something the size of an apple, we can see. Smaller than an apple, it gets difficult.
That means that if you were tracking something bigger than an apple and you knew it was on a collision course with a spacecraft, it's possible to take avoidance provided it's under control, of course. But the smaller stuff, it would just be a case of wham, no warning.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that does and has happened. I think people remember when it was a few years ago, when the space shuttle, the window was cracked by a piece of debris. And that piece of debris was later determined to be a paint chip. Okay, well, that's not very big, but the velocities are very large. And so you can't see a paint chip coming now with our present technology.
David, we spoke to Vibok, an Austrian cosmonaut, or astronaut as they sometimes call them there, and he described the windows of the spacecraft and said that there are little nicks and dinks in it. Do you think that they should be taking a greater care on the design of the space station? That's the International Space Station?
All of this is good stuff to worry about when you're designing a spacecraft. I don't have specific information as to what they're doing on space station, but I'm quite sure that they're aware of the population of particles that they have to deal with and are planning the design of the space station accordingly.
And when are the next big meteor showers that spacecraft operators should be concerned about?
It'll be November 18th, 1999, and they're from the Leonid meteors.
And is it worthwhile people going out on those nights and looking for more meteors than usual?
Absolutely. It should be a terrific visual show to the people on the ground if they're at the right part of the Earth. And by the right part of the Earth, we're actually talking about central and western Australia is a good place. Most of the time, if you have a good dark night and a clear sky, you'll see 10 or 15 meteors per hour. Shooting stars per hour, coming up in November of this year on that night for about an hour at the peak of the storm, you will see anywhere from 400 to 10,000 meteors per hour. So it's going to be quite a visual show.
Well, we'll give you later in the show, folks, the direction to look and to see this meteor shower. Thanks for joining us tonight on the Space Show, David.
Okay, thank you very much.